Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight after too long an absence is poet Martha Solano, and we're talking about her fifth collection of poetry, titled Gravity Assist.
Okay.
Martha, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you after all these years again.
It's great to be on again, Mark. Thank you for having me.
What I told you off mic is really true. It wasn't until I read Gravity Assist that I realized how much I miss your poetry. And for some reason, the way you write, the way that you, there's a lot of phrases from natural history, from science, and you just sort of, you just flow through them. It really touches me. And also, this group of poems is pretty powerful. You grouped these poems after they were written and then just sort of put them together in a certain order, or were they written specifically for sort of an arc of this book?
Oh, no, not at all. The thing you said first, I was writing the poems. In fact, soon after my last book, Reckless Lovely, appeared, I had another manuscript really fast. But it was about four years of trying to figure out the title, the sections, and how I would order the poems, which were being ordered and changed up till minutes before my editor finally said, stop, you can't do it. Get your hands. So I still look at the book sometimes and go, oh, is that really the best place for that poem? Or, you know, I'm pretty happy with when I found the title. I was super, super happy because I had been calling it, the working title had been Mission Boulevard, which is the highway my parents live off of. And I absolutely love Mission Boulevard. But when I started saying to people, oh yeah, my next book is Mission Boulevard, they thought it was going to be about the Mission District in San Francisco. And, okay, that's unfortunate. I don't want to be, because, you know, Mission has to do with space, and it's tied with my family, even though, but Mission, there is a reference in the poem, Ode to Autocorrect, about Mission, that my parents being on Mission Boulevard. You have a photographic memory if you remember that. But anyway, so I was tinkering, trying to figure out a way to get, because as time went on working on this book, more and more stuff was coming into it that just wasn't about science and nature. It was also about origins and proximities in childhood that set me on my course, because my dad is a physicist. I wanted to get all that in there too, so I wanted to have narrative go thread of family, but then further and further out into space until I just break away.
The three chapters of this book are periapsis, which a lot of people may not know that word, but that's the point in the path of an orbit in which you're closest to the body that you're orbiting. And then it's orbit insertion, which is where you sort of power up to achieve a stable orbit. And then escape velocity, which is the speed where you finally break free of gravitational.
Thank you for getting it.
So the thing is, gravity assist is where you actually use the force that's trying to pull you down, gravity, to sort of slingshot your way through escape velocity. So, you know, I just looked at that stuff. I just looked at those three groupings and I went, holy crap. The last time I've seen anything like this was Thomas Pynchon's Gravity's Rainbow.
He tried to do something like that.
Well, the idea of gravity as a metaphor. And actually, Laurie Anderson did something with gravity too and bodies. But this really was much more complex and interesting.
I spent, after this book came out, well, for my release reading, just what you did, I think, you know, the audience kind of just sort of had to know before I could start reading from the book. And I've been pretty much doing that, but the last time I read last Friday in Seattle, and I didn't do that, and then I came home and I just thought, you are a total fraud. And throughout the night, I kept having these dreaded feelings that I had fallen on my face. I didn't, that, but here you tell me this, it reassures me. I mean, I guess I'm still going through because there's been very little attention. The book is not getting a whole lot of attention. Of course, it's been out for 2 months, but I'm waiting for, you know, the phone call that, you know, I'm going to the show.
So you
I'm
should.
Here in my study, looking out the window going, okay, I guess, you know, guess that's all there is. But I'm super, super happy about this book. So,
well, you know,
who cares? But
the contents of the poem reflect it too, because as you talked about, there's things about family and there's a lot about the natural history of the planet Earth. And then there's some really interesting poems about like life on Mars.
And, oh, yeah. You mentioned liking that one. That was the last poem that snuck in because someone said to me when she was reading The Galleys, oh, so you're answered all this ecological peril and
no.
To shoot off. And I said, and I read this book called How We'll Live on Mars.
Right.
You can read it.
I have.
Stephen Petranek. And I took a lot from that book because I thought, no, not at all. Metaphorically, I'm jettisoning away from the things that tied me down.
That's right.
With my family, but I'm not interested. How do you reckon?
Well, you make it very plain that that's not the answer. That it's.
Yeah, so that's why I had to put that poem right near the end.
And, well, you're sort of stuck in this sort of perihelion between Earth and outer space. Like everybody sort of thinks there's going to be a technical fix to everything that's going on, that somehow at the last moment we're going to make everything right.
Yeah.
And it's not happening.
Oh, gosh. My kids have no hope whatsoever. They're so, you know, and I'm the one who's going around saying, we can do this.
Yeah.
We just need to stop idling our cars. And we just need, the great switch has to happen, you know. We've got to lead by example. Like, we have 35 solar panels, and I'm about to get a solar car, and you know, we have to be the pioneers. That's my feeling. And we have to be writing about it, talking about it, and be positive.
This is a question I wanted to ask you, and I'm interested in how other artists answer this question, too, that we live at a time politically and ecologically where I'm fairly old, and I don't remember a grimmer time ever.
Yeah, I try.
And so, as an artist, how do you live through? What do you do? Is it the idea that you write poems like this and put them together and hope people find some kind of inspiration?
Writing through it is like really my number one thing. I mean, I get out in nature whenever I can. I don't just crawl under a rock. I mean, I'm reading about climate change. I'm teaching climate change. I'm helping with change. Putting it into our curriculum, and we just did it at Bellevue College, and University of Washington is interested, and we're collaborating with University of Washington professors now because we're the pilot. So that's gotten me so excited.
Oh, that
and
is
the
good.
Positive spin, and students need the positive. We need to be talking about solutions with them. We can't just drag them down with. I mean, first you have to know. You have to get like a kind of a fear and an urgency. So we start with that. But, you know, just trying to figure, there's so many solutions. I mean, people putting plants on top of, you know, roofs and all these ways that carbon can be absorbed. And they have this sidewalk somewhere in Europe that it's absorbing, you know, just. And, you know, limitless, if there's...
It just is amazing to me that we're at this stage of this game and we're not doing, like, a green Manhattan project. I think there are answers out there.
If we just all go to the polls, I have such confidence that those who don't feel like they got a good deal from the last guy, which I won't mention his name, and those who stayed home because they weren't happy with the candidate, they all went to the polls. It's really a minority, and we know that it's a minority that allowed this to happen. And so if it's I feel like with the right person at the helm, I mean, our Jay Inslee here in Washington is passing like crazy all this stuff. I mean, he just did a body composting bill.
I just saw that on the news. I so want that because, you know, I'm getting old and I don't want to go.
Right.
And that's
so
such
that's
a great idea
for me and my husband. But he's also just signed by 2045. We have to be completely clean energy in Washington state. So what's he doing? He's going way further to the left, and everybody's loving it here. And I don't know, maybe not so much in Eastern Washington, but just pretty much giving the finger to the federal government going about business. And I feel like that's what we all need to do.
I don't
want to look at the guy. I don't want to turn my TV on. I just want to go about as if he's not president.
You mentioned that, you know, to the left. I consider this apolitical. I consider green solutions to things not to be political. It's just a common sense.
Oh, okay. Well, unfortunately, though, we could do a lot. But say for tax incentives, so they just took away, we had to pay the state tax on our panels. It was over $3,000.
Right.
It was gone. Now people are paying $3,000 less. That's a big step. You know, these incentive programs, but they're tied to bills getting passed. Someone had to get up on the floor and say, no more tax for people who want solar. We got to move solar. We got to get off the coal. And here it's hydro and coal, and it's wrecking our salmon, and it's polluting our air. So we're still pretty much, we're a big hydro state. Because of our rivers, but you know, that's not that clean. It's not as clean as we like to think. Still, all these high tension wires going all the way from the mountains all the way down. They lose like 90%. It's the most energy inefficiency known to humankind, and there it is.
You know what, Martha?
Don't get me started.
I know. I love listening to you because you're committed. You're definitely there.
Well, here in my study with my solar panels going to town today.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight after too long an absence is poet Martha Solano. And we're talking about her fifth collection of poetry, Gravity Assist. I think it's your best.
Thank you.
Can I ask you to read a poem and then we'll talk about
it? I would love to. And, you know, here's the thing. This poem that I'm going to read, titled Nearly Every Songbird on Earth is Eating Plastic, it's not a happy poem. But so I hear I'm saying we need to, you know, all this great stuff to be upbeat, but I feel like you have to go to the bad first. So
that's right.
Not a good thing. Okay. Nearly every songbird on earth is eating plastic. Nearly every rip is a crisp packed. Nearly every step is a disabled piss. A slip up is passed. Is past the squawking headline below the photo of a juvenile herring gull clasping in its beak, sailing in its scat, ridding from its ass the remains of a Yoplait parfait. In 1960, 5% of seafaring avians ate plastic. In 1960, fewer sporks, fewer caps, fewer cigarette tips. By 1980, the number had jumped to 80%, a stir, straw, and Starbucks lid explosion, global production doubling by the decade, global lips parting, global rods casting, global disablers digging, global dips subtracting. By 2028, more water bottles swirling in that gargantuan garbage gyre, that loosely collected rubbish spectacle, than all the plastic factory spat since plasticking began. When auklets stab at shrink wrap, when pigeon guillemots gulp Doritos bags, there's no room in a gut for a mollusk, a morsel of crab, punches holes in your organs, strips parts, scraps, scripts. When birds chew blow pop wrappers, guzzle Ziplocs, courtship desists. When one bird eats 200 pieces, when one bird's track departs, subtract how many there were, take two away from three, take away a voice vamoosing, an attic collapsing, a number deeply dinged, teetering on castaway, on doused, on dropping to nil.
That's an amazing poem, and sadly, it's about something.
Oh, you know, I did start by just, it was an article, I think it was in National Geographic, perhaps, online, and I was just going to do a straight-up sort of journalistic, kind of a prose poem, and then I thought, oh, you know, you could play with the language, but it's kind of hard to read, as you, you know, there's a lot of gluck, 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 gluck. But I wonder, I mean, I wanted to sort of make a song of a sort of an elegy, a wail in a way of, it's so, you know, oh, these images of what happens with these poor, you know, animals.
What I love about your poetry is that you're not afraid to use words that people have to look up.
Okay, so there were a few in that one. What would you have to look up?
Actually, almost nothing. Almost nothing. Yeah. But you know, you use a, for instance, fiery skipper, which I happen to have seen here. I watch butterflies too. But you know, words like that, the names of hummingbirds, which a lot of people may not realize, those are all genuine names of hummingbirds.
So I've been accused of people have said to me, well, I like your book, but I have to keep looking at words in the dictionary.
There's nothing wrong with it. Wait, Martha, stop. Stop right there. First of all, I think we all should be going to the dictionary every once in a while because we don't know everything. And it's actually really a cool thing to go and learn something. Wow. What she's talking about.
You're not, you know, I was told very, very early on in writing poetry that you don't just say a bird, a gull, you know, not even a gull. You have to get down to the specific one, and that a poet must know everything, which is kind of a tall order, but in trying to achieve that, you know, and sometimes just the right critter fits, you know, what you need to have happening, and sometimes just the right word for the sound and the sense is not, it's not, I'm not going to dip into archaic. I'm not going to be, there are some who do. I usually don't take words that are no longer in the dictionary or only in the OED, but I do enjoy so much finding just the right word. And
it's as if people who enjoy natural history and science, when they come across your poetry, it tickles you. For instance, I have taught this in my class many times. If I see you, I will seize you and squeeze you till you squirt, which I think is one of the most violent ways of mnemonic devices to remember a bird's call.
Isn't that sort of weird? I know, that's weird. I still can't believe that. And that I read that somewhere. Of course, I didn't footnote it, but that's an actual... That's an actual, what do they call that, mnemonic device?
Mnemonic device. Yeah. And a warbling vireo. Yeah. Now, that's a common nesting bird here. As a matter of fact, they've just returned.
Too.
And every time I hear that, ever since I read that decades ago, I'm trying to go, does that really fit in the call of a war? And I don't see it.
If I see you, I know. Hey, you know what? Thank you for reminding me, because that's about 5 years ago that I wrote that poem, four or five years ago. I'm sure the warbling vireos were going off when I was writing that poem, and I looked it up on All About Birds, and I found that.
First of all, it's incredibly violent.
It's like, I'm going to seize you and squeeze you till you squirt.
I know. It's like Game of Thrones. I don't know.
It is bizarre. Yeah, duh. I say warbling vireo. I can't even remember my own poem. I can remember other people's poems way better than my own.
I think that whole time period where they were trying to write about the way this bird song occurred, so they would use these mnemonic devices. You know, trees, murmuring trees for the black-throated green warbler.
Oh, Sam. Sam Peabody. That was perfect.
That works. I can hear that in my head when I listen to the White-Throated Sparrow, but whatever.
I know. That's my that's the only one. But Chickadee-Dee-Dee, yeah. That still works.
Well, that's sort of that's because its name is onomatopoetic, you know, so it's named after its call. But, you know, the Warbling Vireo is really and there's some I actually have an entire list of these that I pass out to my class and try to have them match up like to a whole list of birds and nobody gets it. And these are adult birders.
Well, that's a fun exercise.
Yeah, it's weird. It really makes you think about what people thought back then about trying to remember. I think these people had no idea of music or anything or poetry. They were just like. No,
but then there, you know, now there's these fossils that are kind of poetic, and now you can put them in poems and sort of, or just be aware that they're out there. They are sort of weirdly poetic, or they say something about the times, I guess.
Apparently, people were doing a lot of violent crap to each other. That's what it says.
They were trying so hard to mimic this. They forgot about the content. I mean, there was a time where word problems were completely just apolitical and didn't have any meaning. And now I've heard instructors in math departments say, no, we have a chance to say something in our word problems. Let's have content.
That's right.
Let's make them be political. You know, let's make them be about being a good person, whatever. You know, why not use the... So maybe the new mnemonic devices will be things like, be a good person, be a good person.
Right. That's a bird that goes, be decent to one another. That's what we want that bird to be around.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not a starling. It's not a starling. Starlings don't say be
a decent... Keep an open mind. Hey, look at this. This is where we've got to.
You're making me laugh too hard.
Good.
I got a question for you, and I don't think I've ever asked you this. How did you start being a poet? Like, at what point in your life did you go, this is what I do? This is the art form I've chosen that is the thing that works for me. When did that happen to you?
Well, see, it wasn't all at once. It was sort of like the little bits of, you know, like the tide, it had to go in and out a few times. So when I was 7, I had a teacher who had us write haiku. And I went home and I started keeping a notebook. I wrote way more than we were required. I just wrote haiku for weeks. And then I guess I put that notebook away because haiku was over. And then at 10 or 9 or 10, I said to my mom, I want a diary. Get me one of those diaries with a lock, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And then, so I wrote every day in my little diary, but that wasn't poetry. But poetry kept knocking on my door over and over. By the time I was 15, I was writing poetry. I don't know. I had good English teachers. I loved Emily Dickinson because I had I had a really good ninth grade and 10th. I mean, all through high school, really excellent English teachers.
Every time I talk to an artist, there are teachers behind every one of their choices of what the art they want to do. And it makes you really realize how important primary school teachers are.
Oh, second grade was my first contact with Emily Dickinson. I mean, it was Robert Louis Stevenson, Poe. But then this lady, it was a woman, and she wrote about seasons, and I love seasonality. Huh. I love the changing of the seasons. So it was just like that moment, sitting in that desk, I can still remember the light bulb going off. You can write about that, and it's poetry. It's in my English book. It's not in a science book. And so I think that was one of the biggest moments, like just like lightning struck. But then to have a ninth grade English teacher who was a poet.
Oh, wow.
We still write to each other. He has five books. He has a whole bunch of little chapbooks and he has a full length. And I have him right here and we're in touch. He sends me pictures of him and his wife and son. And
wow.
I mean, just have stayed in touch, but he was the one who said, we're going to a poetry meeting. We're going to see Robert Bly.
Wow.
Everybody has to come. And I thought, who the heck? What is this? And there was Robert Bly on stage performing his poems. And that night I said, okay, no more bidding. You know, this is it. I want to be like him. I want to get up on the stage and just belt my poems out like he's doing.
Wow.
What luck. I mean, and then so I didn't take a formal class in poetry writing until I was 25 at Portland State. I got brave enough because I was just writing these poems and not really showing anyone
right.
except a couple of my closest friends, and just like most people. But 25, I mean, my undergrad was all academic papers, English major kind of thing. I'm discouraged to write anything creatively. You know, you have to learn all the
right.
who you're alluding to, and you know, someone says John Dos Passos, your work sounds like him. What if you haven't read him? And I thought, oh gosh, okay, here comes, you know, 10 papers every semester. And then I took this class with Primus St. John at Portland State University, and you know, it was a blow because I wasn't good. I wrote a lot of bad poems for a long time.
I think every poet has to write a tremendous amount of bad poetry.
Yeah, and it got to the point where I just knew that they were bad, and I had to just write my way out of them.
Wow.
It was a little bit better after a while, and then I got into grad school, and grad school was a big step because, yeah. So, and I worked with incredible teachers at University of Washington, and yeah, I'm very, very indebted to my teachers there, and so, and it just, keeping at it.
Well, we're almost out of time. I was going to have you read another poem, but we don't have any more time.
Oh, that's okay.
So people are going to have
that's
to buy
a
the
book. Answer.
People are
yeah,
going to have to buy the
book.
It's well worth it. That's all, and I can honestly say that. My returning guest tonight, after too long an absence, and you can tell why too. I'm really glad she's back on this show. Is poet Martha Solano. We're talking about her fifth collection of poetry, Gravity Assist. And there's a lot of poems in there that are just boffo. They're pretty amazing. And so, Martha, thank you so much. I'm going to have it come back soon to read some more poems from this.
Thank you so much, Mark. This is wonderful.
Well,
I really appreciate you.
But would you mind coming back and reading a couple more?
Oh, not at all. We could do that.
Okay.
I'd be happy to do that.
We'll do that.
Sure. That's a wonderful invitation.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.